Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Scarlet Tavern. And more importantly, welcome, wayward travelers. Here is where stories are told in candlelight and truth is chased like spirits in a bottle. And we are here with our continuation of D-Day. And the aftermath and the format and is that a word? Format? Mm. Aftermath? Format? Mm-hmm. We'll say it's a word. And just the things that came around D-Day, all the little things. But where we're at now is D-Day. It's Invasion Day. The longest day in that history.
Sorry, I've watched the movie The Longest Day, and that's how literally Rommel says, oh, it'll be The Longest Day. The Longest Day. Dun, 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 dun.
So it'll be The Longest Day.
Oh, no, 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 no. Not that yet.
Oh, we haven't.
I need to add that to the soundboard.
No, we don't.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to keep Ben on his tangents.
For the least
short.
For legal purposes, I have been told I am not to talk.
No, you're allowed to talk. You're not allowed to go on tangents.
This statement is being made of my own volition and in no way under duress or coercion.
No tangents. This is why I'm doing this one. Otherwise, we'd be here for 12 parts.
And then I would have to rewrite the schedule.
We would just do an entire season of D-Day.
You could do that. I mean,
No.
But me would have good
time. The rest of us have worked too hard on these documents. So, the Invasion Day begins with a problem that feels almost insultingly indifferent to human courage, math, and weather. The planners needed a tight alignment of conditions, enough moonlight for night navigation and airborne marking, a tide state that supported the first assault and the follow-on waves, and weather that wouldn't turn the channel into a wrecking machine or smother the coast in impenetrable cloud. That combination only existed in short windows, and it's one reason the date mattered so much. Meteorologists weren't just checking the forecast. They were effectively deciding whether the operation could function at all. Modern breakdowns of planning requirements emphasize that the moon and tides were deliberately chosen to support the landings, and that the weather forecast forced a delay from the original intended day because the conditions were too dangerous. And that tide piece is more than trivia. The tides weren't simply high or low. They controlled whether landing crafts could unload and retract cleanly, whether the shoreline would choke with immobilized boats, and whether the early assault waves would be forced into a logistical traffic jam before they even met the enemy. NOAA's explainer puts it bluntly. If craft arrived and unloaded at the wrong point in the tide cycle, they could wind up stuck on the beach as the water dropped, clogging the entire flow of reinforcements behind them. That's the kind of failure that doesn't need the enemy to win, it self-destructs. So, the day opens with an almost invisible truth. The assault's first victories are against time, tide, and the physics of getting off a shoreline without trapping yourself there.
Just for everybody, NOAA is National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Yes.
Not NOAA from the Bible.
Yes, because he's dead at this point.
I'm just saying it's pronounced the same way, just clarifying.
I'm pretty sure somebody didn't have that confusion that NOAA and the Ark existed during D-Day.
You know what? These days, would you be really surprised if someone did think that?
And, hon, most people know what NOAA is. In reference to meteorology,
I actually didn't know the whole.
See how smart you are.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know the name of the National Weather Service organization that does stuff.
Did you know you can be a federal agent for that for the Weather Service?
In what world do weathermen need police?
You can literally be a cop for the weathermen. They are federal agents with arresting powers.
Yeah. I got to look that up. I believe you. It's like, what? I want to know what the hell they do.
That's why the final go decision sits on a knife edge. What's chilling is how much rests on ordinary people doing ordinary work correctly, like the Irish weather observer, Maureen Sweeney, at Blacksod Point, recording a pressure drop that helped confirm an incoming storm, feeding into James Stagg's forecast chain and the choice to postpone and then proceed under a temporary improvement. The AP's reporting on her role is a great reminder that D-Day weather isn't a vibe. It's a cascade of measurements, transmissions, arguments, and judgment calls. Even NASA's reconstruction of the forecasting story shows how different forecasting approaches, American versus British teams, competed in those final days and how the decision was made amid uncertainty, not after certainty arrived. Do you want to tell the people what NASA stands for? Do you not know what NASA stands for?
I'm sorry. I forget.
We'll wait.
Wow. Fuck you, Google. National Aeronautics and Space Administration. I hate you both.
Wow, it took you that long. Listen, I got to go to space camp as a kid.
And Mr. Look at me. I'm Mr. I lived on the treasure coast up from the space coast, and I get to go to space camp.
Yeah. Once the launch is set, the day becomes a choreography problem at an almost absurd scale. It isn't bombing, then landing. It's timed layers that must fit together. Air missions working within weather limits, naval fire support constrained by visibility and coordination, and an assault timetable locked to tide and light. Some modern summaries lay out the sequencing in plain language. Air attacks leading into naval bombardment, leading into the first waves, because timing is not decoration here. It's the skeleton holding everything upright. If one layer slips, the next layer doesn't politely wait. It arrives anyway.
This is very true for the airborne landing, because they can't go too early. You tip the whole invasion off, and they're stuck trying to fight off the German army waiting for the landing. Go too late, and the whole point of sending them is...
Yeah. Then the sky becomes its own battlefield problem, because cloud cover doesn't just inconvenience pilots, it changes outcomes on the ground. Heavy bombers and medium bombers operating in poor visibility had to rely on radar and pathfinder systems when they couldn't bomb visually. The U.S. Air Force Museum's explainer on Mickey H2X gives you the fundamental reality. Radar made bombing possible through clouds, not necessarily precise against small, hardened targets, which we have been there. We have seen the Mickey.
I've known exactly. I was like, hey, I know what they're talking
We've
about.
Seen the Mickey. We can touch the Mickey.
Well, we can touch the display that holds the Mickey.
Smithsonian Air and Space pieces on airborne navigation and Rebecca Eureka Tech reinforce the broader theme. World War II technology could do remarkable things, but it still collided with weather, anti-aircraft fire, and the limits of 1944 accuracy. The result on D-Day was the bombardment often did not neutralize defenses the way people assume it did, meaning assault troops hit positions that were still capable of fighting. And unfortunately, the weather is why we had so many casualties.
Especially at Omaha.
The plan was to bombard these beaches and hitting these, because of course you had the Germans had pillboxes there. For those that don't know, pillboxes are basically they had a 300 or almost 360 degree view, because you had the entrance.
Yeah,
you had an almost 360 degree view. I'd say like 200 degree view.
Yeah, they could see the sides, and in front, yeah, the back was obviously their vulnerability.
And they were pure concrete. Some metal, depending on where it was. Yeah,
the dorm was bombproof.
And you had slots just enough to be able to see and the guns to go out. And they were slanted, so it was hard for things to get in. So they were slanted out. So the instead of being slanted in, they were slanted out so that grenades had a harder time getting through. Bullets. They would hit it, and then bullets ricocheted backwards towards the enemy. So those pillboxes, those bombs were designed to destroy those pillboxes, and they kept missing. I don't believe one aerial bomb hit a pillbox.
So
a lot of guys ended up literally throwing grenades into the pillboxes.
Yeah. Omaha is obviously anyone who's seen Saving Private Ryan.
Great movie.
It was a great movie. Very true. They went through a meat grinder.
Yeah.
The way it was, the bombers were supposed to do most of the damage. Ships can only carry so much, and they are just not that accurate.
Yeah.
Actually, some of the pillboxes were destroyed.
Just not enough.
Yeah. I mean, they were still slaughtering people.
Exactly. It was very inconsistent. You know, in Omaha, they missed. For the most part, they missed. Utah, I'd say about half and half because the casualties in comparison just weren't there. Juneau, where the Canadians landed, was pretty bad. But Sword and Gold weren't that bad. They were able to... They only got modest resistance, and Sword and Gold is where the British and the Scots
landed. So, speaking of Saving Private Ryan, if you've ever seen the movie, Steven Spielberg, amazing. He did an amazing job. Probably one of the greatest directors of all time.
Yes.
You know that if you've ever seen it, the first 30 minutes of the movie has no dialogue.
No.
At all. It doesn't. It was supposed to.
Really?
The original script, Tom Hanks was supposed to talk to the men on the boat and say, look at the men on your right and left. Those two men will die today. So make sure you're not one of them. Because every two out of three soldiers were supposed to die. And so he was supposed to do all of that and tell them to smoke one last cigarette and this and that. And it was cut. So I was watching an interview because what's their names from Boston, the Best Friends
actors. Oh, Brazilian Isles?
No. I don't know. The best friend actors.
Oh, I know.
Good Will Hunting. Yeah.
Matt Damon.
Yeah. So they're doing a press run right now because they have the new movie The Rip, which looks amazing. This is the first time they worked together since Good Will Hunting. But they were in that movie.
Oh yeah, they
were.
Well, Matt Damon.
Matt Damon was. So he was in the latter half. He was in the end of the movie.
Yeah.
But so he was talking about the script, and when they got the script, the first 30 minutes had dialogue, and Steven Spielberg went, "Nah, we're gonna not do dialogue all the way up until they hit Omaha, and then dialogue's gonna start."
Well, because again, that's generally how it happens. I mean, you're about to go hit a combat situation. You don't know whether you're going to, are we just going to run into a couple of pillboxes with some bombed out Germans who just refuse to give up? Or are we going into a meat grinder? Oh, meat grinder it is. And okay.
It was a stylization choice. It was perfect.
It worked very well.
It made you feel it. And then they were talking, he talks about how the filming happened, how they opened the lens all the way to allow more light in. And that's what gives you that, like, makes it feel like you're filled with adrenaline when you're looking at all these bullets. Steven Spielberg wanted you to feel like one of the soldiers.
I know
people walked out of the theater, the vets that were there.
Yeah.
They walked out of the theater. They were having PTSD episodes because it was so realistic.
Because a lot of them, again, 1950s to the 80s. World War II films were coming out. Most vets were kind of like, yawn, whatever. Yeah, I guess that one's kind of true.
So they saw this one. They were like,
oh my god, I'm back at the beach. What the hell's going on?
They were having PTSD episodes.
It was bad.
You have not seen it, first of all, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Second of all, go watch it. You can find it pretty much anywhere. It's a great movie. We need to watch it. I haven't seen it in forever.
Same.
Shout out to Nathan Fillion's first movie.
Yes, it was. He was in it.
He is the other Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
He is the one that they tell him his brothers died, and he freaks out. He's like 8 years old. And then Vin Diesel's in it.
Yeah.
When he had hair.
We need to rewatch it because I forgot all these people.
They got a lot of like little big time guys to do cameos.
Well, at the time, most of these guys weren't big.
Like Paul Giamatti.
They weren't big stars. Like Vin Diesel wasn't a big star. Nathan Fillion wasn't a big star at this point. And we see him now and we go, oh my God, they got a lot of big stars, but they probably got paid a few hundred dollars to do this role.
Oh yeah, probably.
So, but Naval Gunfire 2 gets mythologized.
Mythologized. Florida education, everybody.
Do we want to talk about you not knowing NOAA and NASA?
Anyway.
As if it were a guaranteed sledgehammer. Naval fire support had to balance destructive power with timing, observation, and the terrifying possibility of hitting friendly forces as they closed the beach. The U.S. Naval Institute's analysis argues that naval gunfire did not achieve the systematic neutralization people imagine, especially in places where earlier aerial bombardment didn't land as intended. So ships ended up trying to resolve close-in problems under challenging conditions. Some of the whys live in doctrine and allocation choices, but what matters on the day is the effect. A lot of strong points were still alive when the first waves came in. And I'll say, again, I don't want to go off on too many tangents, but what was supposed to happen is the bombs were supposed to hit the pillboxes, and then the naval fire was supposed to go behind that, and because the naval fire wasn't heavy enough to destroy the pillboxes.
Yeah.
But they were supposed to go in and just kill any of the Germans that were inside those pillboxes.
Because
they had big, heavy weapons in there.
Yeah, they were supposed to finish off what the Air Force
could. But since the bombs weren't dropping right, those rounds were just and not doing anything.
It depends on the ship. A destroyer can destroy a bunker.
But you only have so much range, too.
And exactly. That's the problem.
They can't get in too deep because of the way the tide was falling.
The Germans, if I remember correctly, they put, like, bombs in the water. They put...
Yes.
Like, the stars floating up.
Yeah, most of those were there for the infantry and tanks.
The caltrops.
But the biggest problem also was that there were 4,000 ships of various kinds. So trying to jostle, trying to get there, and again, bigger ships can only go so far before they get stuck.
And then you have to worry about, you have all these troop carrier ships coming in, and then you've got to worry about, okay, if we miss, we're hitting our guys.
That's the problem.
And so they were very careful of where they were firing. They were firing far off, because if they fired too close, they're hitting our guys as our guys are trying to advance.
Exactly. And that was the problem, because by the time they realized the ships, because again, Bradley, who's one of the commanders on it, he's on a ship. He's on the USS Texas, I believe. He is literally there getting reports from like flash signals and everything on the beach is saying, these defenses are still here.
Yeah.
And at that point, like you said, it's too late.
You start bombarding, you're killing our guys.
Yeah. So at this point, they just got either fight through it or die.
Yeah. So it's where you hope to be the last guy off the ship.
Yeah.
Because then bullets are focused on other people.
Yeah.
So another part of the day that's easy to miss is how much it depends on marking, making darkness legible. Airborne Pathfinder teams went in with tools designed to guide incoming aircraft to the right zones. Portable beacons like Eureka, which we still use a version of, paired with aircraft receivers like Rebecca, again, we still use versions of these, plus visual markers such as specialized lights and signals. So now, back then, again, this is the Army Air Corps still.
Yeah.
But when the Air Force branches off because of this, they create a specialty for this called the Tactical Air Control Party, mm-hmm. or TACP. That's what I was wanting to get into, but the slots were full. They literally jump in, airdrop in, take a targeting system, paint the target, bombs come in, and they leave, and you never see them. Mm-hmm. They are some TACP or some fucking badasses. I met a couple of them.
It's sad because the Army got rid of their pathfinding program.
Yeah, it's all Air Force now. Yeah. Air Force is typically the only ones that have it. So what'll happen is Army Marines, they will go in like SEALs, Rangers, Force Recon, they'll all jump in with PJs and TACP.
Yeah.
So you'll have one or two TACP guys, one PJ. For those that don't know, that's Air Force Parajumper, Pararescue. They are some crazy badasses too. That is airborne medics.
Yeah.
I know a couple of them too, but so they'll jump in with them. And cause again, the Army, after the Air Force split, they didn't really need it because they're not the Air Force anymore. They don't have planes anymore. They rely on the Air Force. Navy, though, does have some Eureka systems because they still have that stuff. Yeah. So veterans organizations and museum write-ups describe these devices and how they were intended to serve as a navigational handrail at night. Technology existed, the concept was sound, and the conditions were still punishing because the teams carrying the markers had to land, orient, set up under pressure, and keep it functioning long enough for follow-on waves to benefit. That's not glamorous heroism. It's technical problem-solving under lethal stakes. On the eastern end of the seaborne landings, you also see something that's emotionally powerful precisely because it's small but huge in meaning. Free French commandos fighting alongside British forces, like we had said in the last episode. Contemporary local history sources around Ostraham and broader World War II writing. Philippe Kiefer's unit emphasizes the symbolic weight of French troops landing to help begin France's liberation, an act that carried morale value far beyond their headcount. It's one of those human narrative beats on a day otherwise dominated by machinery. France wasn't just being fought over. French forces were present in the fight.
And these were the only French forces that initially landed at D-Day. They were only ever after they came on like the reinforcement waves and everything. It's actually a pretty harrowing story about them taking Ouistreham.
While all of that is happening on the Allied side, the German side is experiencing a different kind of chaos, not panic, but slow, contested decision-making under uncertainty. The German response on June 6th is shaped by command structure and reserve control, especially the question of releasing armored formations and coordinating movement under air threat. Imperial War Museum's overview, the German response, describes June 6th as slow and confused, noting that von Rundstedt sought Hitler's permission to release formations from the armored reserve and that the key formations did not arrive as practical lead elements until later. Mm-hmm. The National World War II Museum's discussion adds texture about how German armed forces were allocated and commanded in a compromise structure that satisfied no one, precisely the sort of arrangement that produces hesitation and friction on a crisis day, which is exactly how the Allies designed it.
So, Rommel von Rundstedt were in charge of defending France. Rommel wanted the panzers right at the beach. They had like 10 panzer divisions in northern France. He wanted them at the beach. Von Rundstedt was like, no, they have to defend Paris, Reims, and all the major cities. Von Rundstedt was senior. He got the decision was his. D-Day happens. Hitler, the night before, had a really bad bout of insomnia. Pam could probably relate to that. So he decided...
You're just like Hitler.
Fuck off!
I did not say that. I did not even mean that.
Might as well have.
Yeah, Jesus.
So he took an Ambien, or whatever the German equivalent of an Ambien was. So he
That's
was,
Ambien.
Ambien, whatever.
I took an Ambien.
So he fell asleep in the morning as the invasion happens, and Hitler was known to mood swings. Nobody woke him until afternoon. I know.
Right? Mood swings.
One
day he loved the Jews, the next day he gassed them.
Von Rundstedt wouldn't go against
Hitler. Sure, he was a male. It was just a Hitler PMS day when he created the concentration camps.
Hitler did create the concentration camps.
Yeah, well, as we will find out, we'll see in our next
spoilers.
Episode. Yeah. Von Rundstedt wouldn't go against Hitler, which is funny because von Rundstedt hated Hitler. The only panzer division that actually attacked at Normandy during the day, that thing was the 21st Panzer Division. That was just because it was moving and happened to be there. So the area commander ordered them to attack. There's actually a very famous quote. He said, "The fate of Germany depends on your actions today."
Let's see how that worked out.
It actually, believe it or not, in a tactical sense, they won, because that division was the reason why, if you look at a map of all the beach links up, that was the reason the British were cut off. They drove right to the beach and cut off the British from the Canadians. So, but it ended up not being enough, because by the time, like we said, by the time they released it, it was too late.
We were already up the beach.
Exactly.
So by the time daylight fades, what makes the day feel so enormous isn't one single cinematic moment. It's the fact that it's a stack of interdependent actions that all have to work well enough at the same time. Weather and tides aligning just sufficient to launch. Timing sequences holding together. Navigation and marking creating order out of night. Bombardment doing something even when it can't do everything. Assault forces adapting to whatever they find, and defenders reacting inside a system that isn't built for quick clarity. That's the real shape of the longest day, a war built out of timing, systems, friction, and human improvisation, where the margin between it worked and it collapses is terrifyingly thin. And when the sun goes down, on my side of town, the story doesn't end, it changes shape. Because once you've survived the first day, the fight becomes about whether that was what was gained enough can be held, strengthened, and kept from being rolled back before it entirely takes form. So, after the landings, the campaign doesn't immediately become a sweeping liberation narrative. It becomes a grinding contest over where the front will even exist. The Germans try to keep the fighting confined close to the coast, because if they can prevent the Allies from capturing key road networks and cities, they can slow the buildup, disrupt coordination, and potentially create conditions for a decisive counterstroke. For the Allies, the immediate objective isn't dramatic conquest. It's consolidation, linking lodgements, securing key terrain that allows lateral movements, and building a continuous front that can absorb shock without snapping. Official U.S. Army histories describe the early phase as a contest in which German forces tried to contain the Allies. In contrast, Allied forces fought to expand and stabilize their position in Normandy. And what was supposed to happen, and what eventually did happen, is you had all these landings across the beach. And of course, if you look at this part of France, you've got these chains of beaches. Mm-hmm. So everybody landed on their different beaches. Obviously, Normandy is the most famous. That's what we know. But what was supposed, because that's obviously, well, for Americans, that's the most famous, because that's where we landed. I'm sure Canadians learn more about their side.
They learn more about Juneau Beach. Yeah,
because that's their history.
Yeah.
But so what was supposed to happen is everybody lands, and then they were supposed to sweep up and then eventually get off the beach and connect onto the mainland. So now you go from fighting all these different fronts of small military to a massive conglomerate of every troop in the world that has fought against you. And it was supposed to be so overwhelming that the Germans were just going to collapse.
And also a byproduct, as we talked about in the last part about the deception, a big part of why it succeeded was because all the best German troops were in Calais.
Yeah.
What we had here was
because we fucking confused them.
Exactly. They sent their best troops. What we had here, Omaha again is the exception, because again it was just a patchwork. But a lot of these units here were actually the German equivalent of penal battalions. Yeah. These were made up of Soviet prisoners of war who had decided to, you know, I'm tired of camp food, I want decent food. So they fought for the Germans and ended up starving anyway.
Or some of the Germans that got in trouble and were, instead of being in the brig, they are being forced to sit here
on a beach with
no
food, no water. They have,
and also where nothing's supposed to happen. So you're not going to get medals for this.
So literally there was only a few like battalion sized good German units, like Fallschirmjägers, which are German paratroopers.
Yeah.
That's what the 101st went up against. But that was really it. There were very little tanks.
Which is why we were able to take as much as we were when we ended up getting to ground off the beach.
Exactly, because if we had hit
the... Because we sent our best to the beach.
Yeah, if we had gone up against the better German quality troops...
Probably wouldn't have worked, but when you send the 101st from the army into a place that's not... I mean, it's quote-unquote heavily fortified, but not as much as it should have been... They're gonna fucking This is what they're made to do.
Bolshevik Jaegers were by far the best troops the Germans ever had,
but they had no training compared to ours.
Well, and also they hadn't done any airborne ops for that part. And what's a battalion gonna do against a division? I mean, realistically, it's not gonna do anything.
So one of the reasons this period feels so punishing is that it's a war of limited visibility and maneuver, which changes what success looks like. In open country, success might be measured by miles. In Normandy, success is often measured by a single village or a single ridge line because those points control roads, observation, and artillery placement. The fight becomes intensely local. Seize ground that gives you sight lines. Take junctions that let you move sideways. Deny the enemy the ability to shift reserves cleanly. The U.S. Army's campaign narrative emphasizes that the enemy's defenses in the terrain slowed progress, turning advances into hard-fought steps rather than sweeping moves. Then there's the urban side of Normandy, often overshadowed by beach imagery. Of course, that's what we're used to seeing is the Omaha beach. But Omaha wasn't just a beach. It's central to why civilians remember the campaign as a catastrophe. Towns became battlegrounds because they sit on roads and bridges, and because solid stone buildings can be defensive positions as much as homes. Fighting in and around French towns means destruction, sometimes from deliberate German defense, sometimes from Allied bombardments intended to break positions, and always from the simple reality of modern war colliding with civilian geography. Britannica's casualty breakdown doesn't just give battlefield numbers. It also emphasizes the enormous civilian toll in Normandy during the campaign, which is a reminder that liberation can arrive with devastating immediate costs for the people being liberated. And that's kind of where we get the sacrifice the few for the many. Yes, some of the French may die, but we're liberating France as a whole. And that's where you get into that moral dilemma. Is it worth it? Is obviously in this aspect it was, because everybody would be speaking German right now. So Cayenne. There's so many different pronunciations.
I've heard Cayenne.
I've always heard like Cayenne. Becomes the campaign's psychological anchor for this kind of warfare. Not because it's the only hard fight, but because it illustrates the slow motion brutality of trying to achieve a key objective against entrenched resistance. Cayenne is strategically significant as a road hub and as terrain that influences movement across the region. But in practice, the battle around Cayenne becomes an attritional struggle in which the enemy commits armor and strong formations to hold ground. At the same time, the Allies apply pressure through repeated operations. Even broad educational summaries note Cayenne as a focal point of the fighting. And the reason it matters for this is that it demonstrates the campaign's central theme. A win can take far longer than the map makes it look like it should.
Yeah, Montgomery, who was in charge of the British and the Canadian forces there, he arrogantly thought he could take it in one day. He literally thought that the Germans, like you said, they would just run.
Yeah.
He'd take it in the day because it was significant for the roads, also major airport there. It's also the biggest city in Normandy.
Yeah.
At least it was at the time. So.
And it's.
I pulled up the Britannica article. 12,200 civilians of. French civilians were killed and or missing.
Yeah.
It was brutal. It's because everything is so packly tight in there. There's hedgerows. There's everything in there. So,
and keep in mind, the whole point was for us to take the small cities in Normandy and then have eventually the British, the Canadians all kind of form up. And then Normandy becomes the focal point and our, supply chains and where we operate for the rest of this war. Mm-hmm. Normandy was that, was going to be the area of operation or the AO.
Yeah.
So it would, and eventually the goal was to have it as a green zone, a safe zone, where we just kind of were able to sit there, throw up, get into these buildings, throw up whatever tents, have our armaments there, things like that. But it wasn't as easy as they thought it was going to be.
No. That's also the reason why the Germans wrote Normandy off as a potential thing. Everything is so congested, narrow roads, head roads.
It's too hard to operate. Like, bringing a tank through those roads is almost impossible without hitting a building.
And those roads were built, like, just around the Viking era.
Yeah, so, and keep in mind, like, even at this time, and I mean, even now, if we look at France and Italy, a lot of people ride scooters or motorcycles because the roads are so narrow. So coming in with Jeeps, because the Willys was what we used, one of the best Jeeps ever built. We used the Willy. We had tanks. I mean, when you see a fucking Abrams trying to roll through a small thing, it's going to tear buildings down because it's so wide. So while the ground fight chums, another war is happening in parallel, a war of sustainment, not at the dramatic level of can we land supplies, but at the daily level of can we keep units fed, fueled, and armed while fighting in terrain that punishes movement.
And it's churns, not chums.
Oh, it looks like, it looked like chums.
Chum in the waters, they're trying to attract sharks.
Yes. Roads chum into mud. I mean, it kind of makes sense. Into mud under heavy traffic while maintenance becomes relentless. Medical evacuation is complicated by distance, congestion, and the chaos of the front. Logistics isn't just a background success. It's a constant vulnerability because every delay in the supply chain makes the front more brittle. The D-Day story timeline repeatedly notes the struggle to build up and maintain the beachhead across June and July, showing how the after story is a continuous effort to keep the invasion from starving itself. This is also the phrase where air power, this is also the phase where air power's role shifts from supporting the landing to shaping the battlefield in a way that's both powerful and imperfect. Allied air superiority doesn't magically erase the enemy, but it does punish significant daylight movement and complicate German reinforcement and resupply. That forces the German side into compromises, movement at night, dispersed routes, slower concentrations, and increased friction in command and control. At the same time, Allied ground forces still must clear each hedge and village. Air power can be disrupted, but it can't occupy. The tension, massive air advantage paired with stubborn ground resistance is part of why Normandy feels both inevitable and agonizing slow in hindsight. Then, as July drags on, the campaign becomes a contest between two different kinds of endurance. On the Allied side, the question is whether they can keep applying pressure long enough to crack German defenses, whether through exhaustion, loss of key positions, or operational overextension. On the German side, the question is whether they can keep coherent defensive lines while under continuous attack and constrained movement, and whether they can deliver a counterattack strong enough to restore containment. Some official and educational sources frame Normandy as an attritional struggle that demanded relentless persistence, and that's the most honest way to describe it. This wasn't a clean race forward. It was a sustained pushing match until something broke. When the German defense finally begins to fracture, it doesn't collapse like a building. It peels back in pieces, like an onion. The campaign transitions into pursuit and encirclement dynamics, where the central drama becomes not just advance, but can you close the gap before the enemy escapes? This is where operational coordination becomes decisive. Converging advances, controlling key routes, cutting retreat corridors, and turning localized breakthroughs into a strategic trap. Accounts of the late Normandy phase highlight how Allied forces moved to encircle German formations, culminating in a pocket known as the Falaise Pocket. And that is French, so it's F-A-L-A-I-S-E. but it's fillet. I didn't want people to think it was like fillet of fish.
No, you're right. Yeah, it's
it is French. That represents not just defeat, but disintegration. Units attempting to withdraw under pressure, abandoning equipment, and trying to avoid annihilation. It's the end of containment and the beginning of Germany losing its grip on France in a way it can't reverse. And some people that have never been to war, have never had the training, will say, okay, well, you're gaining ground. Why not just let them run away? Well, what does that do? That allows them to retreat
and fight again,
re-strengthen their forces, where we can either kill them or capture them. And guess what? That's less people that they have.
So with this, the Fellay Gap, there was a bit of a controversy at the time, very quickly. Patton wanted, we didn't encircle it fast enough. Patton actually disobeyed orders. He went beyond, which is a theme with him. He went beyond where he was supposed to go. And it took Bradley personally going down there and telling him, George, you will stop now or you will be, you'll be fired. Eisenhower has told me to do this. Well, I need to take this town because it's the last road out of this area. If we take it, the German
are trapped.
And he said, no, Montgomery's going to take it. And Patton's like, Monty's going to move too slow and they're going to get out.
I already have people right here.
Yeah. And, but Bradley wouldn't hear it. Ike wouldn't hear it. Monty wanted it. He got it. And of course, Montgomery took too slow. Now, yes, the Germans did lose a good chunk of their equipment, but
a lot of people escaped.
And most of those men would end up fighting at the Battle of the Bulge.
And killing a lot of people.
And in fact, when Patton got into the area and he started capturing Germans, basically said, oh, by the way, Ike, because he never let Ike forget.
These are the people that I could have stopped.
I'm encountering elements of the former German whatever army.
Yeah.
And he's like, I wonder why. And
yeah.
Ike was just like, and it's like, but I was like, just he was let right. him take it.
He's already there.
Yeah, it's like, it seemed like half the time Eisenhower was just fulfilling people's egos. I'm amazed he was able to win this war.
Yeah. And that's why this forgotten portion of the story matters so much. It's the phase where success is converted from we got ashore into we can keep going. The landings create a foothold. Normandy after D-Day creates a front, then turns that front into a rupture. Without that drawn-out, brutal, deeply unglamorous campaign, June 6th is just a day. With it, June 6th becomes a turning point. And once you trace that arc, containment, attrition, fracture, pursuit, you're left with the same unavoidable question that sits beneath every victory narrative. What was the price paid by soldiers and civilians to make that turning point real?
You can almost say it was a longest day.
So.
I fucking hate you guys. You know that, right?
The cost also shows up in the process of counting. Because counting itself is itself a battlefield for some people more than others. Some people can't do math. Looking at the two of you. Casualty reporting in a fast-moving, chaotic operation is never clean. Units lose rosters, men are separated from their formations, bodies aren't recoverable right away or at all, and confirmed status can lag days or weeks behind reality. That means the numbers you see in reputable summaries are often the result of a long administrative struggle to turn chaos into records. And that struggle matters because it's part of the human experience of Normandy. Commanders making decisions with incomplete information, medics triaging without knowing what's coming next, and families back home living in limbo. At the same time, the system catches up to what happened on the ground.
In some cases, it was deliberate.
Yeah.
So I didn't put in the numbers, but for the Normandy invasion, Germany, 30,000 were killed, 80,000 were wounded, 210,000 were missing.
Yep.
United States, 29,000 were killed, 106 wounded and missing. United Kingdom, 11,000 killed, 54,000 wounded and missing. Canada, 5,000 killed, 13,000 wounded and missing. And France, like we said before, 12,200 civilians were killed and missing.
Yeah.
And in some instances, with the American side, in case they actually held back some of the notifications, was for the 29th Infantry Division, which originally was a National Guard division from Virginia. So they were one of the first people to hit the beaches at Normandy in Omaha, and they got chewed all the hell and gone.
Yeah.
So that whole Northern Virginia, Maryland area is actually noted as one of the highest concentration of death notifications, but the War Department actually specifically staggered out the notifications because they did not want that area.
That's bad press.
I mean, because literally imagine, because again, it's the National Guard unit, so most of these guys are all from the same area, same town zone, whatever. Can you imagine a whole town, half a town?
Then you have an uprising.
Or at least it's just, it's bad press.
Yeah.
And then people start asking, like, why did you send a whole division into the meat grinder?
Yeah. Because that's how a war is. Another layer of cost is the moral weight embedded in triage. In popular memory, wartime medicine can look like pure heroism, and it is. But it's also a series of impossible choices. Triage means deciding who can be saved with limited time and supplies, who needs immediate surgery, and who, horrifically, won't survive no matter what you do right now. That's not just a clinical decision. It's emotional damage carried by medical teams and comrades who had to watch it happen. This is one of those costs that never shows up in a casualty table, but absolutely shows up in the lives of the people who survived that day. And there, we have stories of World War II medics that talk about how they literally had to sit there and watch somebody choke on their own blood because the amount of supplies that they would spend saving that one person could save six others. Mm-hmm. So they had to watch them die. And I give them a lot of credit.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there's the hidden cost of quote unquote minor wounds. A lot of injuries that aren't immediately fatal still rewrite a person's whole future. Shattered joints, nerve damage, hearing loss from concussions, infections from contaminated water or debris, and chronic pain that becomes a lifelong companion. Many veterans didn't come home fine. They came home functional enough to be sent home and then live the rest of their lives with bodies that never really returned to baseline. The war ended, but their war didn't. It had just changed shape. And then, of course, psychological injury is its own category of cost, mainly because 1944 didn't have the vocabulary we use now. PTSD didn't exist.
No, it was known as shell shock.
Yes. People carried what we call trauma, survivor's guilt, and stress injuries without a clean framework for acknowledging them. Some buried it. Some drank it quietly. Some couldn't keep it quiet. Normandy produced not only grief for the dead, but a massive population of survivors who had seen too much in too short of a time, and then were expected to keep going, keep fighting, and keep functioning. Even the people who, quote-unquote, did everything right could end up haunted simply because they were there. Captivity and displacement adds another dimension that's hard to grasp if we only think of it in terms of battle. Prisoners didn't just lose freedom, they lost time. Months of hunger, exposure, uncertainty, and the constant knowledge that the war is still happening and you have no control over it. Civilians experienced a different form of captivity, not behind wire, but inside collapsing routines. When your home becomes a battlefield, you lose the basic structure that makes life feel real. Sleep, safety, food, school, work, and the certainty that tomorrow will resemble today. Even when people survive, that kind of destabilization is a wound. The landscape itself becomes part of the bill. Normandy's costs included cratered roads, destroyed bridges, torn apart farms, shattered utilities, and entire neighborhoods erased. And because so much of Normandy is villages and small towns, the destruction wasn't concentrated only in strategic targets. It hit ordinary places where families had lived for generations. The aftermath meant rebuilding not only buildings, but records, local governance, livelihoods, and community memory. Survivors weren't just repairing walls, they were trying to stitch everyday life back together in places where normal had been blown apart. There's also a cost on how memory gets carried forward. Cemeteries and walls of names don't just honor the dead, they do something else too. they freeze the scale into something you can't look away from. A casualty statistic can blur and do abstraction. A row of identical markers refuses abstraction. The same is true of the missing. The absence becomes a permanent presence, a name without a known ending. That's a special kind of grief, and it's one of the cruelest costs of large-scale war, when the story never resolves for the people who love them. And of course, now we have great organizations like the Palmia, Prisoners of War Missing in Action, and companies like we have. There are companies that actually go out to and over the last 10-20 years, it's happened a lot, where people have gone out to Normandy and tried to find relics, and they found old dog tags and stuff like that, like buried deep in the beach. And
I knew a guy when I lived in Boston, when I worked for Dunbar Armor. He was a Native American guy. His grandfather had actually been captured. This isn't normally, but just kind of how they find relics. He got captured at the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
He took his gear, like the little Bangalore, like whatever they call it, they held all his gear on, and he got captured by the Germans. The only reason he didn't get executed was because he was a farmer, so he had skills.
Yeah.
And years later, he went back to visit the area. He found the old farm that was there, and the barn was still there. He walked up. Gear is sitting right there. It was like up in the, because he was found in the attic.
Yeah.
And the farmer just, nobody had been up there.
Yeah. So what it costs isn't a single number, and it isn't even a single kind of suffering. It's death, yes, but it's also injury, uncertainty, long-term disability, psychological harm, captivity, homelessness, ruined towns, and families trying to rebuild a sense of safety in places where safety was physically torn apart. And once you sit with that, once the victory stops being cinematic and starts being human, the next question naturally follows. What did all of that sacrifice change? And why has this particular battle stayed so sharply carved into collective memory? Normandy still matters because it's one of the clearest reminders that history isn't made by a single moment. It's made by systems colliding, leadership under uncertainty, alliances under strain, and institutions trying to convert values into action without breaking. That's why professional military education keeps coming back to it. The National Defense University piece explicitly frames Overlord as something that still inspires and instructs by forcing modern planners to measure themselves against a real-world operation that demanded coordination across land, sea, air, logistics, intelligence, and civil responsibilities, while still allowing for mistakes and friction. It's not remembered because it was flawless. It's remembered because it worked in conditions that punished the smallest failure. It also matters because it's an antidote to a very modern problem. We confuse information with certainty. Normandy is a case study in decision-making when you can't know everything. The National World War II Museum, which I'd love to go to, makes the point in a devastatingly simple way. One of the best ways to grasp D-Day's importance is to imagine what failure would have meant, including the reality that another landing might not have been possible for at least a year. That's not drama. That's the strategic consequence of lost ships, lost specialized equipment, lost training units, and a political shockwave that could have changed the war's trajectory. Normandy matters because it forces us to admit that the outcomes we now treat as guaranteed were once balanced on judgment calls. And think about how much the Germans could have done in a year.
Oh, yeah.
That would have won them the war.
I don't know if it would have won them the war.
Because the deception would have failed.
Yes. But what we would have happened was, logistically, the Germans at this point are already strained. The Soviets are bearing down on them. And the Soviet strategy was basically clog the guns of the enemy with our dead. So I believe the Soviets would have eventually overrun the Germans. It would have cost them far more, but we would have seen a year of completely under Soviet dominance, communist France, communist Germany, Italy. And then
who knows if that stops over there. They come over to us. We're now weak.
I mean, we were only allies of convenience with the Soviets. We
obviously, because literally
Cold War happened.
Right after this, we go right into the Cold War because Russia's trying to flex their muscles, which if you want to see what life is like in
a communist country,
kind of alternate reality Cold War, you can watch our new D&D show, The 13th Sigil, which is a few years after the end of World War II, coming into the Cold War. And
listen, I'm not saying the commies are the bad guys, but they're somebody's bad guys.
You guys are going to see some commies.
Damn commies. But realistically,
that's a perfect segue.
This would have been there. Politically, this could have upset everything. I mean, Churchill was not a popular prime minister before the war. Well, actually, he wasn't the prime minister at the start of the war, but he wasn't a very popular politician to begin with. And he held a coalition by Fredbear.
Yeah.
Roosevelt's election was coming up, too, and he was going to go
for definitely would have lost that one.
I mean, this could have really upset a huge balance. I mean, I'm not saying it's we'll never know completely, but World War II would have ended a whole hell of a lot different.
Yeah. So Normandy still matters because it helps set the template for how large democratic coalitions fight, messily, argumentatively, but with a scale capacity that authoritarian systems struggle to match over time. It's not a vague teamwork lesson, it's a structural one. Overlord required coalition partners to align priorities, share burdens, and coordinate enormous resources toward one operational purpose. NDU's framing leans into this as a modern lesson. Joint forces today still wrestle with sequencing, synchronization, and the gap between plan and execution. Precisely the kind of challenges Overlord puts on full display for anyone willing to study honestly. Ben, what's the NDU?
National Defense University.
Good job. Especially since we just said it. Were you Googling it?
No.
It matters too.
You have no proof of that.
Really? Because Normandy is one of the sharpest examples of leadership accountability surviving contact with ego. Speaking of, Eisenhower's In Case of Failure message isn't famous because it's eloquent. It's famous because it's a leader publicly and privately preparing to take responsibility for a catastrophe. Multiple sources note the same telling detail. He misdated it July 5th instead of June 5th, a small human error that underlines how real the stress was. In a world where leaders are often outsourcing blame like it's a hobby, Normandy's legacy includes this uncomfortable standard. If you order a gamble, you win the outcome. Normandy also still matters because it is one of the most enduring public classrooms for civic memory, and not just in the patriotic sense. It's a place where commemoration forces people to reckon with questions that don't have tidy answers. What does liberation cost? What does obligation mean between allies? What do we owe the people who did not come home? The Imperial War Museum's framing ties Normandy directly to the liberation of France and the weakening of German capacity to exploit it. Yes, but the deeper point is that the campaign is remembered because it's legible. You can stand on that coastline and physically grasp how enormous, risky, and morally frightened the undertaking was. And I would love to. I'd love to go visit Normandy.
Yeah.
And it matters because Normandy didn't just end the war. It shaped the stories nations tell about themselves afterward. For France, it sits inside a national narrative of occupation, resistance, and liberation. For the United States, Canada, and Britain, it sits inside a narrative of coalition responsibility and sacrifice at a distance. Those narratives shape diplomacy and identity long after the shooting stops. That's a big claim, but you can see the mechanism and how often Normandy anniversaries are treated as major civic events and educational touchstones, not just historical trivia. Institutions like the National World War II Museum explicitly position Normandy as a turning point of 20th century history, not merely a battle, because its consequences spill outward into how the modern world was shaped.
And the Germans, it's very
The German, they swept it all under the rug and hit everything.
If you asked them, you would have thought
that. I will tell you right now, if we lived in Germany, we would not be allowed to talk about this.
It's a weird thing.
They try to any talks about World War II, they're
older generation, yes. They were taught as children, we don't talk about it.
It didn't happen.
Just shut up.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the younger generation like ours, believe it or not, they're actually very curious about it. They're kind of like, okay, yeah, World War II happened. We were the bad guys. Whatever. Yeah.
And when you look at Normandy through that lens, systems, leadership, alliance obligations, and the long shadow of consequences, the takeaway isn't remember this because it was famous. It's remember this because it shows what it costs to change the direction of history and why that cost still echoes.
Really?
What we owe the past isn't worship or a highlight reel. It's honesty. None of this felt inevitable to the people living through it, and we shouldn't retell it as if it were. We owe them attention and humility. These were real people, not props, and it's easy to judge choices when you already know the ending. We owe the past context, so history doesn't turn into a costume. And we owe it responsibility now, because remembering only matters if it sharpens how we live, what we value, and what we refuse to repeat. The simplest version. We owe them the dignity of being remembered as people, not symbols. Next time on Scarlet Tavern, we're stepping into one of the darkest how did this become possible stories in modern history. How the Holocaust wasn't just hatred, but a system built through language, bureaucracy, and logistics until murder could run on a schedules and paperwork. We'll trace the path from early state programs like ACT T4, to deportations and rail networks, into Auschwitz and other killing centers, Chełmno, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka, where industrialized death wasn't engineered to be fast, hidden, and repeatable. This episode is heavy, graphic, and deeply human, so take care of yourself and come prepared to sit with the truth. Any final thoughts as we wrap up D-Day?
I wish we had more time for this because there are very many personalized stories that I know for a fact have never gotten into history books. I could go on, and the sad thing is we can't do that. And these people deserve to be remembered. Nobody, that's the problem with topics like these. Everybody always goes for the headlines, but yeah. As we said, this was not a Hollywood film. This was a messy ballet that was made up of people who most of them didn't even know how to dance.
Well, and maybe next season, if people are interested, we'll go into the smaller stories, the smaller operations.
Yes.
Talk about the specific people that were involved, the people that didn't make it home. Yeah. I mean, we could literally have a whole episode just reading the names of the people that died.
Exactly.
It's and what we're going to get into in the next episode is it's brutal. It's graphic.
That one we may want to actually bring the drinks back for that one.
It's brutal. I mean, we're going into Auschwitz and, of course, like I said, the other killing centers, Auschwitz being obviously the most famous because it was the most highly populated.
It was the largest.
Yeah. But Sobibor, Treblinka, those were just as brutal.
And Sobibor, which was the only, as we'll cover more, was the only successful uprising of all the concentration camps.
That one will definitely be listener discretion advised because we will
listener and a viewer discretion.
We will get into the nitty gritty of that. We may throw up some visuals for those that are watching us, throw up some of the visuals of what the concentration camps look like and things like that. Now that we're doing this new format, we can do that. So we can show various pictures of each concentration camp as we talk about them, because we do have those pictures. That's the it's definitely something that needs to be remembered.
Yes.
100%. I want to go to the museum.
The one in DC?
I have not. Well, I've been there, but I was like 8. Yeah. I've not been there in a very long time.
I would like to see it. I've never saw it.
I've seen it.
The big part I remember is seeing the shoes. That was the worst.
I was there as a teenager, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I struggled not to cry the entire time.
Because they also do events where, like, you get a card and you become one of the.
Yes.
My person died.
I was in high school, a classmate of mine, his family went there. They all got cards. And
you get to keep the card.
Yeah. Out of all of them, it was mom, dad, his sister.
And yeah. If you go with a family, they try and pair you up like your actual family.
They all got cards. So they didn't, I don't think they gave them a individual family, but out of all of them, they all got in different people. Yeah. I think the parents got like a married couple, but all the kids got separate different people. Out of all of them, that's like 5 people. 1 survived.
Yeah. And when you go there, like if you bring your kids, they will give your kids a kid. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that, yeah. So that they can understand. Because it may be brutal, but I think it's very important to take your kids to that, because unfortunately, our history books aren't teaching a lot of this stuff anymore.
Because and this is where we will only – this is the closest we will ever get to political.
Yes.
And our social commentary, but we are sanitizing way too much.
Yes.
I'm sorry if people are offended. Oh, my sensibilities, blah, blah, blah. I don't care. You know what? That kind of passive thought process, I'm sorry, you can all hate me, this is what started the Holocaust. Because everybody was like, oh, it'll never happen. They would never do that. Even the Jews who were being herded into the ghettos, almost right up into the trains that took them away like they were cattle, were like, they won't ever do that. Yes, they will.
And I will say, they did. One thing, if you go to the Air Force Museum, which is right here by us in Ohio.
Which is awesome. I highly
recommend it. It is free.
It's free.
It is free. You can go there. They do ask for donations. Donate to them. They're great. It goes to keep the museum alive, get new things.
Air Force Museum, if you want to sponsor us for something,
we would love to do an episode there.
We will do an episode there and something that's part of your display. I already have 3 ideas.
And so what's cool is you can actually go and see one of the trains that was used for transporting to the concentration camps, and you can physically touch that train, and you can see it. You can see the hash marks of them counting the bodies, and so it's amazing. Go, I definitely suggest going if you are in that area, taking a trip to Ohio. Go there. You can do the whole thing in probably 4 hours.
Just be prepared.
It's a lot of walking, but it's amazing. We typically go and one day we do half and then we go again a few weeks later and do the other half.
Also, if you want to go into the planes, you can go into them. Be prepared. They are way more cramped than I thought.
Yeah. So, but with that, thank you for joining us tonight in the Scarlet Tavern, where the candles burn low, the stories burn deep, and the truth is always one drink away. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.